Bill O'Reilly here. This book is dedicated to all American history teachers, past and present. Prologue. Ohio Country, North America, July 9th, 1755, 1:30 p.m. The long knives are out. The face of Captain Daniel Hyacinthe Marie Lenard de Bougeot is striped in war paint. Primeval forest conceals his French Marines, Canadian militia, and Indian allies as they maneuver into position. Hidden behind boulders and ancient oak trees, they await the massive combined force of the British and colonial armies now marching toward them. Bougeot's French and Indians are heavily outnumbered. Unlike the British, they don't have cannon that can kill and maim dozens with a single blast of canister shot. Instead, their weapons are those of a nimble guerrilla fighting force, muskets, tomahawks, war clubs to bash skulls, and sharp knives for slicing the flesh and hair from a dying man's head. Captain Bougeot clearly sees the dirty crimson uniforms and miter caps of the 44th and 48th Regiments Grenadier Companies. These foot soldiers at the front of the British ranks are an elite fighting force. As best the French commander can tell, they number about 300 men. He has scouted the enemy well and knows that hundreds more British and Americans follow behind them in a thin mile-long column hemmed in on both sides by the woods. Bougeot is stripped to the waist in the manner of his Indian allies. Bear grease smeared on his torso will make him slippery and more difficult to fight when the combat becomes hand-to-hand. The 43-year-old father of nine never tires of defeating the British. Killing them, he has written in his journal, fills him with joy. His weapon of choice is a musket made at the Tulay Arsenal in Saint-Étienne, France. The Indians under his command, warriors from many tribes, are so enamored of this lightweight weapon that they ask for the Tulay Fusil by name. But right now, those guns are silent. The French and Indians hold their fire as they await the moment when Bougeot will stand tall in a forest to wave his hat. That's the signal to attack. Oblivious to the coming ambush, 23-year-old George Washington sits gingerly in the saddle at the very rear of the British column, guiding his horse along the narrow path leading straight into the hidden enemy. Dressed in the blue uniform of the Virginia militia, Washington is in agony. A tall and charismatic young man with large hands and a face marked by smallpox scars, Washington rides atop a pillow to protect his ailing backside from the pain of hemorrhoids. A rumble in his belly signals yet another attack of dysentery, forcing him to abruptly guide his charger into the forest in search of discreet relief. The young Virginian contents himself with the knowledge that the march is almost over. After 6 weeks and 290 back-breaking miles through the wilderness, the British Army is just one day away from reaching the French garrison known as Fort Duquesne, which it plans to destroy. Washington's intestinal illness forced him to travel flat on his back in a covered wagon until yesterday, but it is vital that he ride into battle on horseback. Just 1 year ago, he was the officer who fired the first shot in the war between the British and the French. The volley fired by a young Virginian in the backwoods of America set the world on fire, is how one British historian will describe the incident. Indeed, Washington's decision to attack a small French scouting party, killing all of its soldiers, will launch what will become known as history's First World War. In time, the fighting will spread far beyond North America into Europe, Africa, and even India. But that moment of impulse eventually led to public disgrace. Soon after the skirmish, Washington suffered the humiliation of surrendering his Virginia militia to the French at a battlefield not far from here, known as Fort Necessity. In order to avoid a wider war, the French allowed Washington and his men to return home, but the stigma of failure still hangs over the ambitious former surveyor. He has returned to this forest as a volunteer, seeking redemption, by using his knowledge of the lush woodland trails to assist the British commander, General Edward Braddock. Unbeknownst to George Washington, however, the battle he seeks will not take place tomorrow. It's happening right now. 300 miles away in Philadelphia, 49-year-old Benjamin Franklin sits naked in his bedroom. He's reading a book with the windows wide open while enjoying the rejuvenation of his daily air bath. Franklin eagerly awaits word of the British Army's great victory, for the French presence in the Ohio River Valley not only blocks America's westward expansion, but also threatens the safety of the existing American colonies. Franklin is not alone. From Virginia to Boston, General Braddock's campaign is a cause célèbre. The French and British have been at odds in Europe for centuries. Now their rivalry is shifting to North America. It was the British who first established a string of colonies up and down the Atlantic seaboard, but the French were not easily outdone, settling land west of the Appalachian Mountains. They call this thinly populated region New France. Beginning in Canada, the territory extends from the Great Lakes south through the Mississippi Valley all the way to the region on the Gulf of Mexico known as Louisiana. The border between the French and British colonies is poorly defined. One region in particular, the Ohio River Valley, is highly coveted by the British as a means of expanding their sphere of influence. General Braddock has been sent to America with the singular purpose of taking possession of this land. But there is also a more tactical reason for the impending battle. The French soldiers in the Ohio River Valley are limited to the garrison at Fort Duquesne. They are in a defensive stance right now, dedicated to keeping the British contained on the coast. But in time, Fort Duquesne could serve as a jumping-off point for a French assault on the British colonies themselves. If that happens, their Indian allies will be free to loot and pillage colonial farms and towns. Fears of the French and Indians sweeping into Pennsylvania and Virginia have churchgoers ardently praying for the general's success against our neighboring enemies. Many colonists are so confident of Braddock's abilities that toasts to his victory have already been raised throughout the colonies. Benjamin Franklin, however, is not ready to celebrate. The balding postmaster is a few inches short of 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and what many consider a very large head. He has been in a common-law marriage for 25 years to Deborah Reed, a buxom beauty 2 years his junior. He sired an illegitimate son with another woman before their union, and Deborah has given birth to 2 children, one of whom died from smallpox at the age of 4. The gray-eyed Franklin favors a vegetarian diet and appears portly but is in fact muscular due to his passion for swimming. He's an inventor, writer, firefighter, publisher, postmaster, and scientist. But most of all, Benjamin Franklin is patriotic for a nation that does not yet exist. Franklin's current focus is protecting America from the growing French threat. He seeks to form a union of the colonies that will provide this protection. But instead of seeing him as an ally, the British see him as a gadfly. His efforts to meet with the Iroquois Indians to broker a peace are viewed as interfering with the power of the king. Despite British animosity, Franklin's ingenuity saved General Braddock's expedition in April when the general himself declared that he could not proceed into the Ohio River Valley due to a lack of wagons and drivers for hauling the food and munitions vital to supplying his army. Franklin and Braddock met in person in late April, just days before George Washington joined the British cause. "I happen to say that I thought it was a pity they had not been landed rather in Pennsylvania," Franklin will write. As in that country, almost every farmer had his wagon. The general eagerly laid hold of my words and said, "Then you, sir, who are a man of interest there, can probably procure them for us, and I beg you will undertake it." Within 2 weeks, Benjamin Franklin presented Braddock with 150 wagons and another 259 horses. Among the wagoneers is a 20-year-old outdoorsman named Daniel Boone. Franklin is uneasy about Braddock's battle tactics. He believes a 60-year-old British general is ignorant about fighting in the wilderness and employs strategies better suited to the empty plains of Europe. Franklin has personally warned Braddock about the Indians' ability to camouflage themselves and strike without warning. He believes the general's plan of traveling through the forest in a single column could lead to a devastating surprise attack. "These savages may indeed be a formidable enemy to your raw American militia," Braddock replied as he dismissed Franklin's advice. "But upon the king's regular and disciplined troops, sir, it is impossible that they should make any impression." Just a few days ago, when 2 good friends requested that Franklin donate to a fund that would purchase fireworks to celebrate Braddock's coming victory, Franklin was uncharacteristically dour. "Time enough to prepare for the rejoicing," he told them by way of refusal, "when we should have occasion to rejoice." "You surely don't suppose the fort will not be taken?" one of his friends asked in astonishment. "The events of war," Franklin replied, "are subject to great uncertainty." A bare-chested Captain Bugeaud now rises to his feet and waves his black tri-cornered chapeau high over his head. Yet the French and Indians do not immediately open fire. Instead, they move toward the British lines, while simultaneously fanning wide until they surround the enemy on three sides. The center of the French line is a disciplined band of Marines well-versed in forest fighting. Their uniforms are not the garish red of the British or even the light blue of the American colonists, but consist of brown moccasins and leggings of a type borrowed from the Indians. Like Captain Bugeaud, many Marines are stripped to the waist and slathered in bear grease. These hardened men now completely block the British advance. A fight is inevitable. Bugeaud has chosen the perfect killing ground to make his stand, offering the British no room to move past the French and toward Fort Duquesne. Indians in the woods outflank the redcoats on the right and the left. Initially, the British are flustered by the sight of the enemy, but their training soon takes over. Answering with cool precision the command to fix your bayonets, they slide the 17-inch triangular blades over the ends of their musket barrels and march toward their enemy with outward calm. On the inside, however, these young men from England, Ireland, and Scotland are terrified. They fear the French, but not as much as they fear the Iroquois and the Delaware. The horror of getting scalped alive has been a frequent topic of late-night campfire conversation. "God save the king," the grenadiers shout, forming into three neat lines to fire the first volley. Most shots go wild. Their brown best muskets cannot be aimed accurately at a distance greater than 50 yards, thanks to a lack of rifling grooves in the barrel. So volley fire is the only way to hit targets at all. Yet the British draw first blood. Two young French officers are hit, one shot through the mouth. The French once again dive for cover. As the grenadiers reload for the second volley, two British 6-pound cannon are dragged forward into firing positions. With rehearsed precision, the grenadiers part ranks as the guns are aimed and loaded into their lines, ensuring that none of them is hit by the deadly salvos of canister shot soon fired at the French. The effect is immediate. If the greatest fear of British soldiers is being scalped, the French and Indians tremble just as mightily at the mutilation brought by canister and grape. Each round contains 56 balls weighing 1.5 ounces each. These flying pieces of hot, jagged metal now shred limbs and torsos. "Every man for himself," cried out in French, echoes up and down the ridge line. The Canadian militia, whom Bugeaud has long suspected of cowardice, abandons its position as its men run from the battle. Bugeaud and his remaining men cower behind the ancient oaks and walnut trees, taking advantage of the cover provided by the white smoke from musket fire that now settles over the land like a low cloud. The British fire a third volley. A single musket ball pierces the forehead of Captain Bugeaud. His body slumps to the ground. No one rushes to check for signs of life. Instead, the battle Bugeaud planned so meticulously continues to rage as he lies face down in the dirt at the edge of a ravine. The captain's death undoes the French. Even many Indians flee the battle. Not only have the British thwarted the ambush within a matter of minutes, but they have done so without suffering any loss of life. Roaring a half cheer of self-congratulation, the grenadiers rush forward to claim their victory, a fatal mistake for many. Not all the Indians have run away. General Edward Braddock once bragged to Benjamin Franklin that these native warriors would be no match for His Majesty's army. The truth is that the Indians are the most experienced fighting force on this battlefield. They have been stealthily observing the British for a month, awaiting this moment of attack. Their knowledge of this landscape and of the tactics required to win the engagement is beyond the comprehension of the pale and blistered soldiers they now face. Even the British officers on horseback, whose bright red uniforms make them such an easy target, are no match for these brave men. As the British grenadiers race forward with great commotion, the remaining Indians now began shooting from the right and the left, unleashing a brutal crossfire that catches the grenadiers completely off guard. The Indians' next gambit is equally unexpected. Rather than standing in one place to fight, as the British expect from their opponents on the battlefield, the tribes run like deer through the woods, bounding over rocks, hiding behind trees to reload and shoot. then sprinting toward a new field of fire. High-pitched war cries pierced the air, making it seem as if the Indians were everywhere at once. It is a scream the British will never forget, perhaps the most horrid sound that can be imagined, one account will later read. The Grenadiers fire a fourth round, but that will be their last. Order is soon lost. The neat lines of British soldiers that launched precise volleys into French lines just moments ago have been replaced by a jumble of terrified men shooting at anything that moves. Indians storm the British lines. The thick, wide clouds of musket smoke add to the chaos. Most of these men will never see England again. This they now know. Panicked grenadiers turn and run. Officers attempting to stop them are ignored, some even shot by their own desperate men. Indians quickly fall upon the stragglers, shouldering their cherished two-fusil muskets so they can kill face-to-face. The sickening thud of spiked clubs cracking open skull after British skull combines with the war cries and musket cracks and the whinny of dying horses. A senior British officer is shot from his horse. As he breathes his last, the junior officer, who happens to be his son, runs to the rescue, only to be shot dead and fall motionless atop his father's body. Captain Robert Cholmondeley of the 48th is also shot from the saddle. He's scalped as he lies wounded. Just 8 months ago, before sailing from his home in Ireland to America, Cholmondeley sensed that this campaign might not end well. "As to my body, where the leaf falls, let it rot," he wrote in his will. So it is. The veteran officer's corpse will never be buried or moved from this spot. He truly will be left to rot. Perhaps the greatest indignity is Captain Cholmondeley's final moment of life as two warriors pull his brain from his head and smear its gray matter on their bodies as a sign of domination. Cholmondeley is not alone in this debasement. Blood is everywhere, in streaks on faces and uniforms, pooling on the forest floor. Dead grenadiers litter the earth. Almost every British officer is shot. The peaked mitre caps that were once the most distinctive element of the grenadier uniform lie scattered atop the carpet of leaves, knocked from the heads of the dead in an instant before foreheads were sliced and scalps peeled away from the bone with expert precision. Each Indian carries a length of cord for handcuffing prisoners, but they have no use for that right now. This is no longer a French-led battle, but rather a lesson in terror meted out by these hardened warriors, and killing is the only thing on their minds. George Washington gallops toward the fight. At first, the distant snap of musket fire seemed a trifle, just British advance scouts trading shots with Indian outrangers. From his position at the rear of the column, along with the baggage, camp followers, and cattle, Washington seemed safe from harm. "We believe our numbers almost equal to the Canadian force. They only expected to annoy us," Washington later wrote of the confidence displayed by the British and the blue-coated Virginia militia, a hardy band of colonists also known as the Brave Blues. But as the sound of shots increased in intensity, followed by blood-curdling Indian war cries, it became clear that this was more than a mere skirmish. General Braddock instantly ordered his top aides, Washington among them, to spur their horses. They now race up the rocky, uneven road, past teamsters and wagons, and toward the disarray that now characterizes the battlefield. A favorite Indian tactic is to kill enemy leaders to create confusion among the troops, and it's clear to all who witness Braddock's arrival that he is every bit the British senior officer. It's not just his age and girth that give him away, but also the beautiful white charger on which he rides and the bright red and gold of his clean uniform. Washington quickly learns that his blue uniform and breeches also mark him. A musket ball penetrates his coat, embedding itself in the thick fabric, but going no farther. His horse is shot out from under him. As the animal collapses in death, Washington is thrown to the ground. He collects the pillow from the saddle and scrambles to his feet, desperate to find a new horse. The smells of carnage attack his senses: gun smoke, excrement, vomit, and urine. Grenadiers racing back from the front have collided headlong with the main body of British soldiers advancing toward the fight. They form themselves into clumps of 20 to 30 men, praying their numbers will protect them. The grenadiers refuse to advance, and General Braddock refuses to order a retreat. The soldiers simply huddle and await their fate. The Indians oblige, shooting men one by one from their protective cover of a nearby ravine. Meanwhile, a riderless horse trots in panicked circles. Washington quickly grabs its reins. In the midst of the battle, he takes the time to place his pillow upon the saddle. Given the horror of seeing men butchered before his very eyes, the luxury of doing battle atop a cushion seems absurd, but there's no other way for him to fight. As he mounts the horse, he winces in pain. In his weakened state, the simple act of pulling himself onto a horse's back requires all his strength. Soon he is astride and once again galloping through the chaos to encourage the troops, but his efforts are in vain. Our numbers consisted of about 1,300 well-armed men, chiefly regulars who were immediately struck with a deadly panic. That confusion and disobedience of orders prevailed among them, Washington will later remember. George Washington has long feared this sort of ambush. His time at Fort Necessity 1 year ago taught him the need for unconventional fighting tactics. He insisted to General Braddock that the elite British troops give up their traditional uniforms and instead fight wearing Indian dress in buckskin tunics, leggings, and moccasins, if not for camouflage, then for greater ease of movement. Washington also encouraged Braddock to abandon the traditional straight lines from the British order of battle, allowing the soldiers to fight as small fire teams in the manner of their Indian opponents. The general ignored him. Braddock enjoys Washington's company and is delighted to have him on staff, but an undeniable air of disdain defines the attitude of the British toward the colonials, whom Braddock at least considers to be second-class citizens. Washington's charisma, wit, and intellect are greatly appreciated at the dinner table, as is his courage in accompanying the expedition as a volunteer aide-de-camp. But in matters of military strategy, George Washington is considered a precocious fool. Washington's hat is shot from his head. Another musket ball nicks his coat. An incredible sort of luck seems to follow him now. The musket balls do not so much as touch his skin. In all, 4 musket balls will strike him today. Yet the Virginian will leave this battle unscathed. His new horse is shot out from under him. Again, Washington is thrown to the ground and hurries to find another mount. Every officer on horseback will be killed or wounded today, all except the young Virginia volunteer. Washington hurls himself onto a horse and weaves through the chaos, his sword drawn as he screams orders for the British to close ranks and return to the fight. He is disgusted by what he sees. They ran as sheep pursued by dogs, he will later write. It was impossible to rally them. It is equally clear to Washington that the brave blues of the Virginia militia are out fighting the British regulars. This is not unexpected. The brave blues are battling to protect their families and homes, knowing that if the French and Indians win this engagement, there will be little to stop them from marauding through Virginia. Yet rather than encouraging the brave blues to continue their successful strategy of fighting behind rocks and trees, treeing in the vernacular of the British Army, General Braddock loudly denounces the Virginians as cowards and dastards, and even strikes them with the flat of his sword to force them out into the open. In the end, few brave blues will return home. They fought like soldiers and died like men, Washington will lament of the fallen. The handful of brave blues who do make it home will bring with them a new spirit of independence. From this day forward, it will be clear that the Americans no longer need the British to fight their battles. In fact, on this day, it is the British who need the Americans, but even they can't reverse the horrible course of the battle. In the first hour of combat, the Grenadiers are routed. In the second hour of fighting, wagon teamster Daniel Boone cuts his horse loose from its traces and joins a group of unarmed teamsters galloping away from the slaughter. Almost all of them will live. In the third hour of combat, General Edward Braddock is mortally wounded by a musket ball. He has had 4 horses shot out from under him and is struck in the right arm as he mounts a 5th. Knowing the battle is lost and that great shame and humiliation will be heaped upon him, Braddock begs for a pistol so that he might take his own life. His aides ignore him. The general then calls for George Washington, the one man who knows his terrain better than any of the British. "Ride," Braddock tells Washington, "ride for help." It is past 4 in the afternoon. Washington is still weak from illness and emotionally drained from the 3 hours of battle. The summer heat and humidity have caused him to sweat through his linen shirt and thick wool uniform coat. He is thirsty and hungry and knows that critical reinforcement and medical supplies are dozens of miles away through the wilderness. George Washington was new to warfare when he surrendered to the French at Fort Necessity a year ago. Though eager and well-meaning, he blundered through that conflict and returned home in disgrace. His courage was never an issue, nor his desire to learn from that debacle. He was sure that volunteering as an aide-de-camp to Braddock might replace that memory with one far more glorious. But the opposite has happened. Braddock is lost. The British have been routed, almost to a man, and the colonies are now defenseless against a French and Indian attack. There is little glory to be gained from what has happened today. The British captives will be paraded back to Fort Duquesne at twilight, the women to be raped, the men to be burned alive for the amusement of the French and Indians. Yet on this day, George Washington ceased being a surveyor and Virginia gentleman. Today, he became a warrior. Strapping his pillow tightly to his saddle, George Washington obeys Braddock's order.
1. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, June 16, 1775, 8 a.m. George Washington is out for blood. 20 years almost to the day after Braddock's defeat, as the infamous battle in the Ohio River Valley has come to be known, the 6'2" Virginian pushes back his chair and rises to his feet. 70-year-old Benjamin Franklin watches him from across the cramped assembly room here in the Pennsylvania State House. Delegates to the Second Continental Congress sit in high-backed chairs, their papers splayed before them on cloth-covered tables, waiting to hear if Washington will accept the new title he has been offered. At the head of the room on this oppressively humid Friday morning, overseeing the proceedings, sits John Hancock, the wealthiest man in Massachusetts and president of the Congress. A man of medium height and build, he is 38 and soon to be married, with a baby already on the way. Born the son of a clergyman, Hancock was sent to live with a rich uncle at the age of 7, after his father had died and his mother could no longer care for him. The uncle had no children of his own, so Hancock was raised to take over the family's highly successful import-export business. In time, Hancock added to his growing wealth by becoming a smuggler of wine, tea, molasses, and tobacco. His duties as president of the Congress are slight, most often mediating debate. On days when the arguments become loud enough for people outside the tall windows ringing the assembly room to hear what is being said, Hancock might insist that they be kept closed. But this morning, thanks to the temperature and thick morning air, they are wide open. Footnote: construction on the Pennsylvania State House began in 1732, but was not completed for more than 20 years. At the time, it was one of the most ambitious buildings in the colonies. In 1824, the assembly room was rechristened the Hall of Independence, which was later shortened to Independence Hall, a name that became synonymous with the entire building. On February 22, 1861, President-elect Abraham Lincoln visited Independence Hall on his way to Washington, D.C. 4 years later, on April 22 through the 24th, 1865, Lincoln's body lay in state in the same room on its way back to Illinois for burial. More than 85,000 mourners filed through to pay their respects. A bronze marker indicates the spot where another fallen American president, John F. Kennedy, spoke while visiting Independence Hall on July 4, 1962. End footnote. Sitting on the aisle next to the second row of desks is Benjamin Franklin. He is weary but attentive, his impish sense of humor nowhere to be seen. Just 6 weeks ago, he returned home from 11 years in England. Unfortunately, his wife Deborah, who had remained in Philadelphia due to fear of ocean travel, had died during Franklin's absence. Shortly before last Christmas, she was felled by a stroke. Her husband got the news while living in a small brick row house between Charing Cross and the Strand, in London. As much as he misses his wife, it is not her passing that lays the biggest burden on Franklin's heart. His original purpose for sailing to London had been to act on behalf of his home colony, seeking to establish a closer relationship between Pennsylvania and the British Crown. But the effort was soon overshadowed by England's exploitative policy of taxing the American colonies to pay British debts. Onerous legislation such as the Molasses Act, Sugar Act, and Townsend Acts forced the Americans to pay duties on everyday amenities such as rum, paper, paint, and glass, with all the revenue flowing to England, all to pay for the same frontier defenses the colonies already provided for themselves. The colonists believed this to be illegal. Even worse, there was no attempt to allow the colonists a voice in Parliament, leading many to fume that taxation without representation was a form of slavery. The Intolerable Acts of 1774 went a step further, punishing the people of Massachusetts by abolishing their provincial government and installing a British general as the colony's new governor. At first, the enraged colonists responded by actually beating tax collectors. With rebellion in the air, Franklin's focus changed. Instead of just Pennsylvania, he found himself representing all the colonies as a diplomat, working tirelessly to keep the peace. Franklin is not a timid man. He knows there is a time and a place for war. In 1755, shortly after Braddock's stunning annihilation left the colonies wide open to French and Indian attack, more than 400 white settlers were slaughtered and scalped in Pennsylvania. It was Franklin who led the call for a state militia to defend the people. His pleas were ignored until the bodies of those dead settlers were brought by wagon to Philadelphia and dumped on the steps of this very state house. 2 days later, Franklin had his army. In his efforts to prevent war between England and America, Franklin has made every effort to be impartial. "In England," he once wrote of the criticism thrown his way, "I am accused of being too much an American, and in America, of being too much an Englishman." Now, despite his diligent efforts, war has come. On April 19, 1775, shortly after he boarded a ship for the voyage home to America, the battles of Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts saw the first casualties of a conflict that would eventually become known as the Revolutionary War. Footnote: in England, it will become known as the War of American Independence. End footnote. On this very day, north of Boston, 1,200 colonial soldiers are hastily building defensive fortifications on the hills of the Charlestown Peninsula. Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill offer a commanding view of Boston, a city of 15,000 people and long a hotbed of loathing toward the British. The Crown has occupied Boston since 1768 as it tightened restrictions in the most rebellious of colonies, controlling the ebb and flow of daily life while carefully monitoring the growing divide between patriots, as the rebels call themselves, and the loyalists. There has been bloodshed as a result of this friction, most notably the Boston Massacre in 1770, when British soldiers fired into a patriot mob, killing 5 men. Currently, a force of 6,000 regulars is garrisoned within Boston's 1 square mile limits. Footnote: regulars are so called because they are career soldiers who serve on a daily basis rather than being called out only when needed. End footnote. Were it not for a thin stretch of land known as the Roxbury Neck, connecting it to the Massachusetts coastline, Boston would be an island. Colonial troops under Artemus Ward control access to the neck, forming a narrow barrier preventing the British from marching out of Boston and expanding their control of the surrounding towns. Yet, while the English may be contained, they are by no means cut off. They control Boston, which means that English ships come and go with impunity, resupplying the regular army garrison and preventing the military siege that would see British food and ammunition choked off. The Massachusetts colony has no navy to contest these vessels, many of which are armed with cannon. Thus, a stalemate has existed for months between the two forces, and continues to this day, despite the skirmishes at Lexington and Concord 2 months ago. If the British were to take control of Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill, the colonists would lose a key strategic position. From their lofty summits overlooking Boston Harbor and the city itself, the colonists can fire cannonballs, which is why the British have spent the last 3 weeks secretly plotting an invasion of the Charlestown Peninsula to capture those heights. But just 2 days ago, on June 13th, the rebels got word of the British plans. Working day and night, they have been preparing redoubts from which to fend off the redcoats. 6 feet high, made of earth, with wooden platforms on the interior from which men can stand to fire their muskets, the square-shaped fortifications are protected from assault by ditches around their perimeter. Early on the morning of June 17th, British warships fire on Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill to little effect. The emboldened colonists endure a sweltering day in the sun as they await the next move from the English. Soon, they spot longboats rowing soldiers from Boston over to the Charlestown Peninsula. The flotilla is massive, ferrying some 1,500 grenadiers and light infantry across the harbor. Some of the colonists quietly desert, retreating back toward Cambridge rather than facing sure death. Those who choose to remain will long remember the confusion of that day as the